So welcome, and I want to thank you all very much for coming. We have a very packed program, a very interesting program. We're hoping to have as much discussion as possible. So please feel free to ask any questions and speak your mind at any time, not while the speakers are speaking. So I will just, rather than start with the usual introduction about how obesity is the leading cause of death and how they've had to redo the rides at Disney World and the seats in the baseball stadiums, I thought I would instead do a sort of David Letterman style 10 interesting facts about obesity. So the premise of this conference is that obesity is caused by overeating, and overeating is caused, has something to do with the brain. And Rodolfo Linus, whenever he starts a talk, he talks about the sea squirt, which in its larval form swims around until it finds a propitious place for feeding, and then it attaches itself to a rock and spends the rest of its life filtering water and feeding in that manner. And when it does this, its brain disappears. So it needs a brain, of course, to swim around, but then once it turns into sort of a plant and its brain disappears. And then there's the koala. This is an MRI of a koala. And I have to admit, I don't know if this is really true, but the koala's brain is very small. All this white stuff is fluid. It's cerebrospinal fluid. And the cerebral hemispheres are tiny and much smaller than its closest relatives. And the thought is that that's because the koala has no decision-making to do related to eating. It eats only one thing, and it lives in its food source. And so the point here is that the role of the brain is to eat. That's why we have a brain. One of the concepts that many people will be exploring today is that hunger is a sort of an addiction, an idea proposed over 100 years ago. Bart Hobel from Princeton has demonstrated that sugar is addictive. Everything you can do to a rat with cocaine, so self-administration, binge consumption, sensitization, you can also do with sugar. The most used weight loss medication in the world is nicotine. This is an ad from the 50s, I guess, showing that you could use nicotine to stay healthy and trim. And here is McGill had its own brand of cigarettes, which it sold to students in order to fund the building of the gym in the 20s. And here they were telling you that now, McGill, this land we're standing on was given to the university by the McDonald family, who made their money in cigarettes. The McDonald company is one of the largest tobacco companies in the world and was based in Montreal. Now, McGill is not only funded by this drug, it's also been funded heavily by people who sold alcohol and also by people who sold food, namely the Molson family. That was a joke. Food, beer, okay. So, the elephant in the room of obesity, and this is something you almost never hear about when you see review articles on obesity, is that one of the major risk factors for obesity is a mental health disorder. People who have a diagnosis of a psychiatric illness are much more likely to be obese or overweight. And you can see that this is true for mood disorders, anxiety disorders, substance abuse. It's also true for ADHD. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the expected incidence is about 4% in the adult population. If you look at an obese adults going for bariatric surgery, they have a 27% incidence, a sevenfold increase in ADHD. And then another one-third of these individuals have ADHD symptoms. Obesity is also an economic disease. In the developed world, obesity predominantly affects the poor, and this is especially true of the children of the poor. According to Drunofsky, 40% of the recent increase in weight, that is in the last 20, 30 years, can be attributed to reduced food prices secondary to agricultural innovation and policy. So when food is cheaper, people eat more of it, that so-called price elasticity. That was used by, the same is true for cigarettes. When cigarettes are cheaper, people smoke more. And that fact was used by the tobacco lobby to say that cigarettes are not addictive. It's a choice, because if it was addictive, you'd smoke the same amount no matter what the cost. And the same argument is being made for food, that people are not so-called addicted to food or to high-calorie foods. They choose to consume it because it tastes good. I just want to show a little bit of my research. Hunger is an incentive state. Ghrelin is a hormone secreted by the stomach that triggers meal times. And we have shown that ghrelin increases brain activity in areas involved in motivation and reward. We've also shown that ghrelin increases the amount of money people are willing to pay for food. So when we administer ghrelin to healthy subjects and have them buy food, they will pay more for the same items of food when ghrelin levels are high. So a gut peptide, a homeostatic signal, has the ability to change high-level behavior. And thrifty genes are coming back. So the thrifty gene hypothesis is that the reason some people are obese in this environment is that they have genes that promote overeating in times of plenty. And there's an advantage to overeating when food is plentiful so that you'll survive the famine that's about to occur. And the thrifty gene hypothesis has been criticized based on the fact that if there was a thrifty gene, everybody would have it. However, Prentice and colleagues have shown that food also affects fertility. So this is weight loss in rural Gambian women, and you can see that weight fluctuates with the seasons. So during the harvest time, weight goes up, and during the non-harvest time, weight goes down. And fertility follows exactly the same pattern. So you can see that 9 months after the hungry period, there are fewer births. This is true for both Gambia and Bangladesh. And so a gene that gave you an advantage in this kind of environment would increase fertility and therefore would be selected for. Hunger, appetite eating is risky. Animals will take extreme risks to eat. This is a polar bear. This is from the BBC great series, The Living Planet. And this polar bear is starving, hasn't eaten in 3 days, and it attacks a walrus, which is three times its size. Polar bear breaks his leg and dies in the attempt to feed. And so when you're very hungry, you have to take risks to feed. Here are some lions attacking an elephant. And here is the chickadee, which bases its feeding behavior on the amount of risk and on its caloric state. But finally, I want to remind you that it's not just the brain. And this is my colleague, Mark Prentke, who pointed this out to me earlier this week. Yes, the brain is important, but obesity is a disorder of energy balance. And the gut, the adipose tissue, the liver, the muscle are also extremely important in control of body weight. So that's my introduction of 10 interesting facts about obesity, and I hope you have a nice day.
Good morning. I am Laura Dubé. I'm a chair professor in consumer psychology and marketing at the Deshotel Faculty of Management here. And I'm also the founding chair and scientific director of what is pompously called the McGill World Platform for Health and Economic Convergence. I will come back later on today once we have gone through the brain presentation. For now, I have just three or four slides to give a challenge to all of you here. In 2005, we were, I think, the first institution that really convened the neuroscientists to say for obesity, we do need to pay attention to the brain and to the fact that we may be creating an environment that presents too much challenge. And what if we were to bring the knowledge of the brain to help this? So we had a three-day conference. It was called at the time Energy is Delight. And we got the cover story that you see there in McLean, how your brain makes you fat and what science can do about it. So my challenge to you is to the outcome of this today is not about how to become sexy and slim for the rest of our life. There is definitely a health benefit there. But progressively over the last five years, we have started to develop what we call the brain to society approach to prevention, to healthy living, and so on. with the idea that we should not support economic development and economic prosperity necessarily by having the same growth in terms of percentage of the GDP of a country and the growth of childhood obesity. So what I'm challenging you to do is to think about currently the approach we have to obesity, whether it's individual or whether it is population level. It clashes with both biology and society. And the question is that could we really bring the science of the brain? Because one of the dominant paradigms currently, the gene environment, there's no brain there. And environment is that thing that makes us sick. And there is action that can be done. The human brain is not just vulnerable to addiction to food and other motivated cues, but it's also able of creativity, able of empathy, and able to change an environment if this environment is not adaptive anymore. So as we go through the day in hearing about the various facets of the brain and so on, try to think about how can we really weave this in helping individuals, but also weave this with other sciences. I always say to my neuroscience colleagues, there is sciences in society too. And if we have to change society, let's bring that science together. And what you get there, it's the cover page of the book that we have been producing over 5 years, and that has just been released a few months ago at Elsevier, about this approach of the brain to society approach to obesity prevention. But you will see later today when I come back, I would say that it's more than obesity prevention. It's for a 21st century science that allow us to ensure health, well-being, and sustainable prosperity for all. So I will stop here, and I'm inviting Nicolina, I believe, and